Thank you. Well, this is such a small group, and my talk is very flexible. So how many of you have heard about this system before? Well, how many of you have no idea what this thing is about? Come on. All right, just to get some idea. I have a lot of introductory material, but I can skip it easily. In fact, I'm going to start with the fun stuff, and I'm going to start with the punchline just to make sure I get to it. So I'm going to tell you the story of this really extraordinary system in the global cluster M4, which we now know, this is the punchline, contains a Jupiter-type planet. And here is a very nice, it's one of the things you get from NASA PR, is a very nice artist's conception of the system. This is in the crowded field of the global cluster M4. M4 is the nearest global cluster to us. It's otherwise a fairly average cluster in terms of its density, for example, and age, metallicity. It's a fairly typical global cluster, not particularly big, not particularly dense. Just happens to be very close to us, so it's very well studied. And here's the system, which contains a radio pulsar. You can see the pulsar right here with its jets or beams of emission. And this pulsar, like most pulsars in clusters, has a companion. The companion is, I think I'm losing my, this pulsar has a companion, which is right there. The companion is a white dwarf star, which has just been detected by HST last summer. This is where the NASA PR came from. And here we now know a much wider orbit around this inner binary pulsar is this planet. And now the question I'm asking you, I asked Eric earlier this morning, is where? What's the viewpoint? Where's the observer sitting?
The observer is sitting
on a nice tropical beach.
Observer and the pulsar, white dwarf, and then the planet.
Where are the little green men in this picture?
Right there.
Of course, they're sitting comfortably on a nice, warm, toasty moon of this Jupiter, which is right here down somewhere, looking at this whole scene. I want to acknowledge many of the people who have contributed to this in many ways. On the theoretical side, Eric Ford, who's here, has been working with me on this for many years, and also Chris Joshi, a graduate student with me. And is now managing healthcare systems at IBM. And a couple of observers who've contributed all the data that I'm going to show you, in particular the latest data and the latest results, Ingrid Stairs and Steve Thorson. And the first thing I'm going to do, just for fun, since this is early in the morning and we all need a little bit of excitement, is show you some animations. I was originally going to show you these animations at the very end of the talk because I have to interrupt my presentation to show them to you. But I'm going to show them to you right now because they're fun and they'll wake you up and maybe they'll wake me up. And what these animations show are the kinds of dynamical interactions that can take place in a dense global cluster like this that would plausibly create this kind of triple configuration with a planet that has now been captured into a bound orbit around this binary pulsar system. So there's only one thing to realize before you even look at these animations, is the kind of interaction you need. And it's fairly obvious what kind of interaction you need in this case. You want to end up with three objects in the end that are bound together. Now, in any kind of dynamical interaction, you just in order to conserve energy and momentum, you always need to kick out at least one thing in the end. Right? So if you're going to end up with three things bound together and you need to kick out one, then obviously you need to have started with four. Right? How you get four things close together to interact? Well, very naturally, you have to bring in two pairs. Okay? That means in this case, a binary that must have contained this neutron star, which ends up in the system, okay? And a star with a planet attached to it. So this is very natural. You're going to bring in a binary star containing a neutron star. There are many of those. They're very common. And another pair, which is the star with presumably a whole planetary system around it, but we're just interested in this one giant planet. Okay, that's the other pair. So let me show you this right now. I'm going to interrupt this and go. I'm going to run. The reason why I'm not showing these as movies is that I'm actually running these dynamical calculations on this computer in real time. The only thing I've done is to keep the initial conditions so that I know what the outcome is and I can show you some good ones. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to show you is just a generic interaction between two binaries, just to give you an idea of what these things look like in general. So there's nothing specific here about having a neutron star or a planet in the picture. It's just two pairs coming in and interacting, two binaries containing, in this case, equal mass stars that are treated as point masses. Okay, and it's very generic. I haven't picked anything special. And I'm just throwing these two things at each other and calculating, integrating F equals ma to see what happens. Okay. That's the first thing you will see. And so there's a pair coming from the left and one pair coming from the right. The left is out of the way. Okay, one was blue and red, and the other one was green and brown. And if you paid attention, you saw what happened at the end after this little complicated dance. Two single stars got kicked out, and you were left with one binary, one bound pair in the middle. And that's generically what you get out of these interactions. You kick out, if you bring in four objects, you kick out two as single stars, and you're left with one bound pair. Okay. Now, let me show you the next one. I have now specialized to the kinds of objects that are relevant here. So I have the binary that's going to come in from the left contains a neutron star with some stellar companion. Okay, it's a generic binary containing a neutron star. And the thing that's going to come in from the right will be the star with the giant planet around it. And it's a generic Jupiter 10 minus 3 mass ratio placed at 5 AU. Okay, whereas the pair containing the neutron star and its companion is a little bit tighter. It has a separation of half an AU or something like that. And the masses are about right for all these four kinds of stars on one planet. So let me run that next one. But again, it's generic in the sense that I have not picked a particular output. I have not picked one that gives any particularly interesting outcome. Let's see what happens in this one. So again, they do their little dance. You see the planet has disappeared. The brown object was the planet has disappeared. Now they're trying to kick out this green guy, and they finally succeeded. What happened to the planet in this case is that it had a physical collision with one of the stars. So it's gone. And then you're left with three stars in this unstable triple configuration. One gets kicked out in the end, and again, you're left with a bound pair. This is the generic result. In all cases of these interactions, you end up with just one bound pair at the end. However, sometimes, you actually form a stable triple at the end. So let me show you one way of doing that here. Let me actually pause it to, it's running a little bit too fast. Okay, so again, the pair that came in from the left is this red and green pair. The red is the neutron star, and the green is some stellar companion to that neutron star. The pair that came in from the right is this blue star, which has a planet around it, and that's the brown object here. Okay. Let's move on in this case. Okay, let me pause again. So now, the blue star, which is the one that brought in the planet, got kicked out, but you're left with this bound triple configuration. I'm going to try to zoom in to show it to you a little better, if I can remember how to do that. And let me see if I can change the viewpoint. Okay, let me move this. Okay, so you see this, the three objects now are all bound together in a stable configuration. In the middle is the pair of the neutron star with its companion, green and red. But now the planet has been left behind in this bound orbit. I'm going to try to zoom in a bit more, see if we can actually resolve these three things. Make the dots smaller. Okay, so now you can get some sense of the relative size of the two orbits. Okay, and the software, which by the way was developed by John Fujot at MIT, is smart enough to decide when to stop at the end. It keeps integrating until it's made sure that the triple is stable and the other object that got kicked out will never come back and interact again with the stable triple that's left. And then it, once it's decided that, it stops.
Okay, so stable?
The famous criterion developed by Rosemary Marling, who unfortunately is not here anymore to hear this. So this is one way that you can get this kind of triple configuration. So you, the binary that came in containing the neutron star, and another pair that came in was just the star that happened to have a planet around it. And the star that brought in the planet in the end gets kicked out, and the planet just happens to be left in a bound orbit around the binary that contains the neutron star.
How far away was the planet from the star when it began?
In all these things that I'm showing you here, it's 5 AU, but you can, you know, you can place it wherever you find it reasonable and then repeat these calculations and try to get, you know, quantitative answers, cross sections, branching ratios for different kinds of outcomes.
So
this is just for fun here.
You say the probability for ending up this way rather than...
We'll get back to numbers. For these kinds of generic initial conditions here, the branching ratio to get this kind of triple in the end is 10%. Small, but not... not unreasonably small.
What's special about that collision that keeps the planet down?
Nothing. It's just one of the possible outcomes. It's not the most probable. It's just one of the many possible outcomes.
Is there something about the initial conditions that tells you?
No. It's all chaotic dynamics, of course, as you can see. So there's just, you know.
The velocity of encounters?
Yeah, so these are all nearly parabolic encounters, which are the kinds that are relevant for global clusters. The velocity at infinity is small compared to typical orbital velocities, at least of binary stars. Okay, not necessarily compared to the orbital speed of the planet, which is further away. Let me show you the last one, and then we can talk about this.
In the case where you get at all four in a big chaotic jumble, then the sauce one is highly favored to be kicked out. But wait, you have it wide enough that maybe you only have, you know, one pass or maybe just a couple, then the initial angles matter a lot more than just the mass ratio. And so if you happen to go by the angles right, you can kick that a little bit.
That's a good point. In fact, what you're interested in here is really the point mass limit of this process. I mean, by the time you're down to a mass ratio of 10 minus 3, you know, it doesn't really matter what the actual mass of the planet is. You're in the test particle limit of the problem. And then the probability of keeping that planet in a bound orbit basically goes to some value in that test particle limit, okay, which, you know, depends on the ratio of separations and masses of the other objects and all that.
So
but it's of order 10%.
It would be much more probable to keep this star rather than the planet. If you're going to kick one,
in this case,
more likely to kick out the,
in a triple,
the star? Yeah.
To keep the star instead of the planet as the second companion in a wider orbit, it's slightly more probable, but not much more probable. Okay, and it's for the reason that Eric just gave, that with a very wide orbit, you know, you never get both the planet and the star to participate fully for a long time in this chaotic dynamics. Okay, so you basically grab one or the other depending on random phases and things. Okay. Let me show you the
background tidal field of the galaxy.
It's completely irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. This is just small n-body dynamics. Let me show.
What's the mean encounter time?
I'll get to all this. This is just a fun qualitative introduction to this whole story. Okay. Here's the last one I want to show you, which is a slightly more complicated way of achieving the same outcome. So again, the neutron star and its companion came in from the left, and we pause it. This is running too fast. My computer is too fast. But now you see the difference is that the difference is that the star that got kicked out is the other star. So in the previous case that I showed you, the star that got kicked out is the star that brought in the planet, the blue one. In this case, the star that gets kicked out is the star that used to be the companion of the neutron star. So what was achieved in this case is more complicated, is sort of a double exchange. The companion of the neutron star was replaced by the star that brought in the planet. And at the same time, the planet was left in a bound orbit around this inner pair. Okay. We'll get to that. This is okay. So let me again zoom in. And hopefully show you a bit better the stripper that's left behind. Okay, now you can see it perhaps better than before. Okay, so the red is the neutron star. The blue is what is now a new companion, the star that came in with the planet. And the planet happens to have been left in this bound, wider bound orbit around the central pair. Okay. Okay. So this is just to give you a taste of the kinds of dynamical processes that make it, in fact, rather natural to expect in a dense cluster environment that if some of the objects that you throw in this dense environment are stars with planets, and some of the objects that you throw in have neutron stars, which we expect to have formed just from the mix of stars initially in the cluster, you get these kinds of systems through dynamical interactions rather naturally. In fact, what's rather remarkable, let me get back to my slides. What was it yesterday? In answer to my sociological comment during Peter's talk, someone said, I guess it was Scott Gowdy, who's not here, someone said, well, isn't it reassuring that in fact there were theoretical predictions of migration before the extrasolar planets were discovered that are now explained by migration? And, well, if you find these kinds of arguments reassuring, then you may like the fact that here Stein-Sigurdsson, right, remarkably, wrote a paper just a few years before this system was discovered, or at least just a few years before it was realized that this system probably has a planet in it in this kind of weird configuration. Stein-Sigurdsson had written a purely theoretical paper speculating about these kinds of interactions that I just showed you and making the prediction that if most stars in global clusters have planets, then it could very well happen that one day one of these planets got captured into a bound orbit around a millisecond pulsar, and then through the magic of high-precision millisecond pulsar timing, that planet would become detectable, which is exactly what has happened here. Yeah. So maybe that, you know, makes it more plausible to you, or gives you a sense that this is not totally unexpected and that the story is not completely crazy. Let me also, as a way of making sure that I get to the end of my talk, tell you what the punchline is. So the punchline, this is really the only thing that's new here, and I will show you the data when I finally get to my talk, is that this object, which we knew, we have known for many years, is in this triple configuration, the outer one, we now know for sure has the mass of a planet. The minimum mass, the M sin I, is right around one Jupiter mass. This is the new thing that's come out from the timing of the pulsar just in the last few years. Before that, with previous data, we knew it was a low-mass object, but the range of masses that were allowed by the solutions for the timing, for modeling the timing data, were somewhere between Jupiter and all the way up to brown dwarf masses, so we weren't quite sure yet that we could call it a planet. Now, this thing should be called a planet in exactly the same way that most of the extrasolar planets are called planets. We know it's a planet because it has the mass of Jupiter. Now, that's, I think, very solidly established now. You get through these other conclusions, and it becomes a little bit more questionable as you go down my list here. I think it's not certain, of course, we weren't there to watch it happen, but it's almost certain that this planet really came from an ordinary planetary system in the sense that this planet formed around one of the normal stars in the cluster. And the only reason that it ended up in this funny orbit around a millisecond pulsar is that there was this dynamical interaction which you expect in the dense cluster environment. We can't be completely certain of that, but I think it's extremely likely. And of course, the reason why this is important is that it tells you that stars in this cluster somehow have been able to form planets, even though this is a very low metallicity environment. I'll come back to the metallicity in a few minutes. So this makes this planet very different from the other pulsar planets that you've heard about, that Alex was talking about a few weeks ago. Those pulsar planets presumably somehow formed in the environment around that neutron star. So they're very different kinds of objects. Planets that look like terrestrial planets from the point of view of their masses, but they clearly formed in an environment and through processes that may have been very different from what we usually think of as planet formation. Whereas here, this planet came from just an ordinary planetary system that formed.
Why do you have the star that get kicked out to be a neutron star?
Sorry?
Why suppose this argument that you made is because one of the guys that got kicked out, you assume it's a normal main sequence star. Why could that star not be one of Alex's star, you know, neutron star that got kicked out? In other words, this planet was formed during a supernova event somehow, and then that was a binary that got kicked out.
Well, I really don't think that Alex's planets, you know, have anything to do with forming during a supernova, but that's a different question. You're asking, why couldn't it be that this planet that we see here actually somehow formed around a neutron star,
right,
in the same way that the planet somehow forms around 1257? There's absolutely no way that that could be relevant to this system. I mean, the inner companion of the neutron star, you know, the thing that you see close to the neutron star is an ordinary stellar companion. That planet is way out there, could not possibly have anything to do with the environment immediately around the neutron star.
Because we already know there is planets around other neutron stars.
Think we also know that ordinary stars tend to form planetary systems,
and
including
with high metallicity. Okay, it's just equal stretch.
You can't say. I don't think it's an equal. You cannot rule out anything. But I think it's very plausible that this planet, which, you know, is as much a Jupiter as any of the other extrasolar planets that you call Jupiters, just formed around a normal star, just like all these other extrasolar planets that we've now detected. And if you throw it into this cluster environment, very naturally, one of those will find its way around this bound orbit.
Right. I agree with what your conjecture is. In a sense, that conjecture has a implication that is inconsistent with the solar neighborhood stars, right?
Absolutely. So this is if I ever get to my talk, these are the kind of things I want to get into.
And also with what you said.
Okay. So,
what is the list of forwards and
I'll get to all this. Let's not get into the discussion before I even start my talk. So as I said, as I go down this list, you know, the first item in this bullet list here, I think, is solidly established. Okay, and now as we go down, we have more and more question marks. Now, many people have been happy to go all the way down to this last bullet here and present this as firm conclusions. Okay, I'm not going to do that, but bear with me for a second. So if you accept this, then, you know, you've understood that this planet that formed around a normal star just got into this weird orbit because of the interaction that took place in this dense environment. The implication is then that a large fraction, this has not been really analyzed quantitatively yet, and in fact, since this talk is supposed to be about what I'm supposed to be working on here, this is one of the things that I would like to be working on here. Since you understand all these dynamical processes, and you also have some theoretical understanding of how the overall dynamical evolution of global clusters work, you can actually look quantitatively at the following question. You can ask, well, given that I see one system of the type we see here, and given that we think we understand the kinds of dynamical processes that form this system, what does that tell me about the actual fraction of stars that must have had planets initially? And obviously, it's hard to do statistics or quantitative analysis based on one observed system, but I think you can do something quantitative here, and you can hope to at least determine an order of magnitude of that fraction. And I think what you're going to find, that this now, just a guess. I mean, some people have presented this as if it's completely obvious that that's what you're going to find. I put a question mark next to it. I think it's reasonably obvious. I expect that the answer will be that a very large fraction of stars must have had planets initially if you're going to end up with one system like the one you see here. And the reason to try to make it obvious to you is that if you take the point of view of this one binary containing the neutron star, one of the ingredients that you need, and you place it, let's say, at the center or near the center of this cluster, where the density of targets that it can interact with is highest. Okay. and you ask, you know, what's the probability that this binary containing the neutron star is going to have as its target for the next interaction it's going to have? That it's going to have as a target a star with the planet still attached to it. Well, obviously, if the fraction of stars that have planets around them is very small, then that probability is going to be very small also. And then if you add the other small probabilities in this problem, in particular the branching ratio to get the right kind of outcome from the interaction, you quickly end up concluding that, you know, the chances that you're going to see a system like the one you see are very, very small. Okay. The only way that you're going to make the numbers work out in the end, I think, is if most of the targets that are surrounding this system that contains a neutron star, or in fact stars with planets still attached around them. Okay. Otherwise, I don't think it's going to work. But I still put a question mark there. I mean, some people have considered this a completely obvious implication.
But do you think that's more than, say, 5 or 10% that we see around solar neighborhood?
I think that's something you will be able to quantify if you do this a little carefully.
I don't think 5 or 10% is really the relevant number here. I don't think we know the relevant number. I mean, I think what everyone's missing is the trend with metallicity could be just an artifact of the fact that things with higher metallicity migrate more. We don't know what's at 10 AU. There might be a lot of planets around stars yet.
I mean, I guess I'm wondering what this ratio. Maybe this one.
I have yet to start my talk. Okay. Yeah, you think you've missed my talk, but I haven't started.
Oh, okay.
I'm just showing you again. And then the last and potentially most interesting implication of all this, which again, if you look at the NASA PR from last summer, for example, has been presented as a now established fact, is that then there must be a way of forming planets in these very low metallicity environments, if you think that they're commonly formed around stars and global clusters. To answer the question that somebody asked me already, the metallicity of M4 is about 1/20th. Of solar. So if you look at the thing that Peter sketched on the blackboard yesterday, probability, or what was it, the fraction of stars with planets and the fraction of metallicity, and somewhere around a third of solar, it looks like it has this dramatic decrease to essentially zero. Okay. This is 1/20th of solar. Okay. It's more than an order of magnitude below that limit talking about yesterday. So this is potentially very, very significant.
Minus 0.6.
Isn't that
metal? Minus 0.6. It's not that
metal. It's about the same. These are both, by global cluster standards, these are fairly metal.
Yeah,
whether that means anything.
This is minus 1.3.
This is z of 10 minus 3. So let me try to go quickly through the talk. Just a quick summary of this system from the point of view of the pulsar detection. This system has been known for a very long time. In fact, it was, I believe, the second pulsar ever discovered in a global cluster. It was discovered almost 15 years ago now. And it's the only millisecond pulsar known in this particular global cluster. Oh, more than 60, I think, millisecond pulsars that have been discovered in the whole global cluster system. It's in M4, which is, as I've mentioned already, is peculiar only because it's the nearest global cluster to us, so it's very well studied, but it's otherwise a very ordinary global cluster, very average in all its properties. 13 giga-year-old cluster, the metallicity I just mentioned is about a 20th of solar. It's been known basically from the time of the discovery of this pulsar that it has a binary companion. The orbit is relatively wide, it's about half a year period, and it's a very circular orbit, and the companion mass has an SI9 of about 0.3 solar masses. Now, these properties are completely, again, ordinary and expected for millisecond pulsars of this type. For those of you who don't know the story about millisecond pulsars, of course, young pulsars that have formed from supernova explosions in global clusters, given the ages of global clusters, young pulsars have been long dead. Typical lifetime of a young pulsar is something like 7 years compared to 10 to the 10 year ages of these clusters. So what's thought to have happened to some of these old neutron stars, dead pulsars that are left in golden clusters, is that at some point they accreted mass from a binary companion. And through the process of accretion, they can be spun up and sort of be reborn as pulsars again. And it's very easy to realize that even with very little mass that you accrete, there's so much angular momentum that comes in through the accretion disk that you can very easily spin up a neutron star all the way to basically its breakup speed, which is somewhere around the Mach 0. And indeed, many of these pulsars are seen to spin with periods that approach a millisecond. That's the four millisecond pulsars. So what you find typically because of binary evolution considerations is that the phase of mass transfer from the companion onto the neutron star typically happens when the companion evolves off the main sequence and becomes a red giant, because that's when it becomes big, and that's typically when it starts overflowing. And so what happens during this mass transfer process is that the red giant that tries to expand basically empties its envelope onto the neutron star. And what you're left with at the end is just the core of the red giant, which is a white dwarf. In fact, a peculiar kind of white dwarf is typically a helium white dwarf, the kind of low-mass white dwarf that you can only get by truncating the evolution of a red giant. Okay. And so you expect, theoretically, if you understand the evolution of the systems, you expect them to have binary companions of a very particular type. You expect to find these low-mass white dwarfs as companions to these millisecond pulsars. And that's exactly what this one is. And in fact, as you all know, the white dwarf has now been detected directly as an optical counterpart by HST. That's what happened last summer. Yeah, that's what the PR came from. And you typically have fairly wide orbits for these binary millisecond pulsars, because if you're going to fit in a red giant in the system, you know, that means a reasonably wide binary. And you typically end up with very circular orbits, because when you have the red giant in the system, you have a very big star there, which has a large convective envelope, so that has a lot of viscosity. And these systems can very, very efficiently undergo tidal circularization. So you end up with very circular orbits. And there are all kinds of other nice theoretical relations that you can derive, given that you understand the evolutions of the progenitors of these systems. In particular, there's a theoretical relationship between the mass of the companion, the mass of the white dwarf, and the orbital period of the system, which just comes from understanding stellar evolution and the Roche geometry. And that particular relationship is very well satisfied by this system as well. So there's really nothing special about the inner binary pulsar in the system. What is completely anomalous about the system, and this became apparent about 10 years ago, this is a few years after the discovery of the pulsar, is that it has a completely anomalous variation of its apparent spin down rate on a time scale of a few years to maybe 10 years. And I will show you in a few minutes what that actually looks like. So all pulsars, of course, are expected when observed typically to spin down. That's just because as they radiate energy, that energy can only come from the spin kinetic energy, and so they must be spinning down. So the pulse frequency is observed to go down at a certain rate, but that rate is typically very stable, okay? So very constant. And what was anomalous in this particular pulsar and was detected early on is that that rate appeared to be changing in a very unusual and very rapid way. Time scale of a few years, which you wouldn't expect at all just from the point of view of what should be happening intrinsically to that neutron star. So one way that, one possible source of that is what's usually referred to as timing noise, which would be something intrinsic to the neutron star, something happening in the interior of the neutron star that gives you a little bit of instability of that rotation rate, if you want. And this has been measured for many small effect, in fact, very difficult to measure for millisecond pulsars. It's been seen only in a couple of millisecond pulsars, I think. And it's at a level that's, you know, orders of magnitudes below the variation that is seen for this particular. So that's something you can eliminate. Something intrinsic to the neutron star you can eliminate pretty quickly, unless there's something completely unusual about this neutron star that you've never seen in any other neutron star. So the thing you start thinking about immediately is an additional source of gravitational acceleration in the system. If you think of just the Doppler shift, anything that produces an additional speed for the neutron star will give you a Doppler shift of its frequency. Right? It's like making that clock move. Of course, the Doppler shift is not measurable at all for a neutron star because you don't know what the reference value is. It's not like a spectral line where you know the laboratory value of the frequency. Here you have no reference. So that Doppler shift, that shift in the frequency, is not measurable. But you can take a derivative and realize that if you take a derivative of the velocity, that corresponds to acceleration, and that corresponds now to the rate of change of the frequency of the pulsar, which can be affected by any source of acceleration. Then you can take the next derivative again. If you have a change in acceleration, that will give you a changing rate of change of the frequency, which is what's seen here. So some source of additional gravitational acceleration that must be changing on a time scale of a few years is what you need to provide an explanation. And so there are two ways you can do that. You need to put something near that binary pulsar to produce the gravitational perturbation. You can do it with, in principle, something on an unbound orbit. Maybe it just happens that you catch this binary pulsar as it's interacting with something that's just flying by. Okay. And you just catch it very near pericenter so that you produce a significant perturbation. You can do a little calculation and ask what's the probability, given the density and interaction rates, what's the probability that you're going to catch this interaction while in the middle of the interaction happening near pericenter. And it's completely impossible, essentially. It's extremely unlikely that you'll catch something that's just happens to be passing by. So the thing you're left with after eliminating all these other possibilities is that there's got to be something else nearby which is actually bound to this inner binary, okay, and produces this perturbation. So that led very early on, before any of the numbers were known and you could do any kind of modeling for the system, that led to the suggestion that this was in fact a triple system. So there was a third object in the system on a bound orbit.
I'm sure you looked into this. That such a close encounter, which is highly improbable.
Well, you
would not have relatively dissimilar.
Well, you know the time scale, right? I mean, this is completely ruled out now. In fact, you can do models where you put things on hyperbolic orbits if you want to try to fit the timing data. Now we know it absolutely cannot be that. But even at the time, just from the time scale, I mean, if you're going to produce this variation in the time scale of a few years, then you know within what distance roughly you must be passing, okay, and that's something like 10 AU or less, just to get the time scale right. Okay. Now, the other thing you might think of is just which has been seen as what it does is it produces anomalous frequency derivative for pulsars, is what you might think of is
the acceleration just from the mean gravitational potential of the cluster.
Okay.
That's a long time scale.
That's, of course, a very long time scale.
Fail completely to produce the effect that's seen. Just independent of the magnitude of the effect, just because the time scale is wrong. Can you rule out also the possibility there may be any kind of disk around this binary that could cause a precession?
I think we now know for sure that whatever is producing these effects, I mean, it's a lot more than just this anomalous frequency derivative at this point, as I will show you in a minute if I get to the rest of my talk. We now know for sure that what is producing all these effects
is on a Keplerian orbit around the inner binary. Let me skip a few things just to get to some of the other punchlines that I wanted to make. So here is one, I think, very dramatic way of showing that something very, very special is happening to this pulsar. And this now includes all the latest data, more or less, to the present. This is the spin frequency of the neutron star, okay, minus some reference value. And yes, all these digits are significant.
And this is the rate of change of that frequency. So this is the first derivative. And at the time the system was discovered, the value was negative, which means the neutron star, as you would expect, looked like it was spinning down. But in fact, this rate of change, this frequency derivative, has been changing so much. And this is something you could have predicted by then, just by extrapolating this data we had over the first few years of timing of the pulsar. This value has been changing so much that it has now actually changed its sign. And this neutron star now, over the last few years, appears to be spinning up. So this tells you something that we weren't actually sure of at the very beginning. One of the numbers we use in modeling the system is this frequency derivative. And in using it effectively, we assume that the intrinsic value of this quantity, the intrinsic spin down in the neutron star, is negligible. And that what really sets this value is the gravitational acceleration, the thing that we're trying to constrain. Okay. We now know very obviously that indeed the value that's being measured is completely determined by this external effect. Otherwise, it could not possibly have behaved this way, changing, not just changing its magnitude, but actually changing its sign. So the way, let me go back a bit. The way we model the system is we look at these pulsar timing residuals. They're shown here. These are the residuals that you get if you model just the inner binary pulsar. You just do the usual modeling of the pulsar timing data. So that means you fit for the pulsar frequency, a frequency derivative which is assumed to be constant, just modeling the usual pulsar spin down. And then you subtract the model which contains all the Keplerian parameters for the orbit of the inner binary companion, the white dwarf. And usually for any binary pulsar, if you do that, you end up with a good model of the timing, which means that you end up with random residuals that look just like noise. That's what's shown here in the bottom. But if you do that for this system, you end up with something which clearly has still a lot of signal left in it. In fact, if you compare the scales, you can see that the signal-to-noise ratio here is something like 1,000. So there's something else that's very obvious, just screaming at you, that's happening in the system that you need to model. And the reason why it's not obvious that this thing comes from an orbit is, of course, that the duration of the observations is shorter than the orbital period. Okay? If you saw a periodic signal here in these residuals, then immediately you would know that there's another thing orbit around the pulsar, and you could do the usual modeling just like you do when you get a Doppler curve. Okay. Now, you cannot do that here, yet you have a very strong signal that allows you to do something. So the way people have done the modeling is to simply do what you can think of as a Taylor expansion around some particular reference epoch, which means around some particular reference point along the orbit of that second companion. So effectively, what you do here is you measure successive derivatives of the pulse frequency, which is just like measuring successive coefficients in the Taylor expansion around that point, that reference point along the orbit. So you can measure the next derivative would be the second derivative of the pulse frequency. This is the one that corresponds to the rate of change of acceleration. And then you can just keep measuring higher and higher derivatives. Every time you measure a higher derivative, you get an additional independent constraints on the parameters of that second orbit that you're trying to study. And you can easily count the parameters that you have in the problem and realize that there are 5 independent quantities that you're trying to determine that would give you a complete solution. So by the time you have measured 5 successive coefficients in this expansion, effectively 5 successive derivatives of the pulse frequency, you have a complete determination of the orbit. Even though you may still not have covered the full orbit, you may only be looking at a small piece of that Keplerian orbit, but if you look at it with enough precision, measuring none of these coefficients, you can still determine the orbit. People who measure orbits know this very well. You don't have to have a full Doppler curve to measure an orbit. If you can measure it very precisely over a short segment, that's good enough. So here's one way of determining this. This is from when we did the exercise carefully with Eric years ago. Here are the five unknown parameters. There are two angles. The longitude of where the object is now, this is sort of that reference point along the orbit. And then there's the longitude of pericenter with respect to which this angle is measured. Eccentricity, the mass of the perturber, m sine I, this is your usual projection effect, and the semi-major axis of that orbit. Okay. Now, at the time that we did this carefully the last time, there were four successive derivatives reasonably well measured. So if you have five unknowns and you have four constraints, that gives you one parameter family of solutions, which is what is shown here with these lines. And there was a rough guess for the value of the next derivative, the fifth derivative, which would put you somewhere in this zone here, but this was very, very preliminary. In fact, it was one sigma detection at the time. So we already knew back then that the mass of that perturber, that outer object, was constrained to be somewhere in the range of maybe a few Jupiter masses all the way to a few tens of Jupiter masses. So it was getting to be really interesting, but we couldn't say yet that it was definitely a planet. And it could have been just equally a brown dwarf. And of course, people think that there might very well be lots of free-floating brown dwarfs in star clusters in general, so you had to be, you couldn't so let me get to the punchline. This is including all the latest data from Ingrid Stairs and Steve Thorsett, and I have to make sure to tell you that this is not published yet and that they reserve the right to change their numbers. This is preliminary.
He changes his number.
What? But there is now, so this is the same kind of plot I just showed you before, except it's the observer's version, so the angles have disappeared because they don't care about the angles. Okay. These are the interesting quantities, the eccentricity of the orbit, m sine I, the orbital periods, and the semi-major axis. Of course, these two things are basically the same. And these lines show you the one-parameter family of solutions get just from the first four independent quantities you measure. And now the thing that's new is that there is a measurement of this fifth derivative, which gives you the fifth independent quantity that in principle you can use to get the full solution. And so that means you can place a point on these one parameter families of solutions and say exactly where the thing is. And that's, at the moment, that's this red dot that's shown here along each curve. So the punchline is that we now know that m sine I is just about one Jupiter mass. This is in solar masses. It's actually a little less than Jupiter mass. And the orbit is a period of about 45 years, which means that the 15 years of timing data cover about a third of that outer orbit. And the corresponding semi-major axis is something like 20 AU. And the eccentricity not that high. All right. So I think this establishes the first bullet that was on my list of conclusions that I've shown you already. But I think it's absolutely established now that this object is as much a Jupiter as anything else you call a Jupiter among currently detected extrasolar planets. The mass of this thing is right around Jupiter. I'm sure there will be by the time they publish their results. It's now a real detection. I will leave it at that. And in fact, you just ask your department chair if you want more information. Okay. So this you've all seen. This is from last summer. It was nice only because it got a lot of publicity. This was the detection with HST of the inner white dwarf companion of the pulsar. Paper by Sigurdsson et al. In Science got to the front page of the New York Times somehow. Here's the this red error circle. In principle, this is a very easy exercise to do.
know the position of the pulsar very accurately from the pulsar data analysis. And so you just take an image of this field, and you look where you know that the pulsar is,
and you
try to see an optical counterpart. Okay. Many people have done this exercise and done it wrong in the past. If you look at results from the mid-90s, you will find two abjay letters, independent groups claiming to have detected an optical counterpart of the system that made it at half a solar mass mid-sequence star. And what they probably have detected all was this blob here. Okay. Doesn't find the right one.
You can,
having detected the counterpart, you can put it on a color magnitude diagram. This is the color magnitude diagram of M4. This is the main sequence up here.
This is a very nearby cluster, so it's sort of the ideal place to go look for faint objects.
And indeed, lots of white dwarfs have been detected in this cluster. Okay, they're all here. These lines here are cooling tracks for white dwarfs. As you move them from left to right, you're changing the mass of the white dwarf. Heavier white dwarfs, like your ordinary sort of half a solar mass CO white dwarfs, are all here to the left. They're fainter, of course, at constant temperature, because a heavier white dwarf is smaller, so you have less surface area. Okay, so this is changing the mass, and then along each cooling track, once you know the mass, of course, you have a chronometer. As time increases this way, as the white dwarf cools and becomes fainter and fainter. So this blue dot here is the detected white dwarf companion of the pulsar. And so if you place it on the right track, you know both the mass and the age. And the mass is around 0.3 solar mass, which is exactly what you're expecting from the pulsar timing. And the age, these are different ages in giga years. Okay, this is 0.1, half a giga year, 1 giga year. And it looks like the age is just about half a gigahertz, which has interesting implications, which obviously I won't have time to get into, for how exactly the system formed. One of the things that was puzzling before is that if you ask, what's the lifetime of the triple system in the cluster now?
You know the size of the outer orbit.
And you have some idea of where it is
in the cluster. You only have some idea because you see it in projection, right? Where it is, how close it is to the center. It's actually in projection right at the edge of the core.
So kind of dangerously high density area.
If you compute the lifetime of that outer orbit, depending on where you place it exactly in the cluster, it could be as short as 2 by 10 to the 8 years. Okay. Now, the typical age of a millisecond pulsar,
if you just look at age derived from the spin down time.
The typical age of a millisecond pulsar is more like a few billion years.
They're typically very old.
So this was always a problem.
Because all these nice scenarios that I showed you, where you do the capture of the planet, they would all tend to form, to recycle the neutron star, to spin it up, and form the millisecond pulsar after the triple was formed.
Which means that the millisecond pulsar could not be very old, because if it were very by now, it would have interacted again with something that planet would have been kicked out. Yeah. So the fact that the age of the system turns out to be rather
short is very nice. Okay, if the system has been around for only half a giga year, then it's reasonable to place it in the cluster in three dimensions at a distance from the center where the density is such that it could have actually kept that planet there for that long. Okay. So it sort of all fits in nicely. Really the only new thing that came out of this HST work. Okay. They made it into the discovery of the century, as if you know, now we know there are planets in global clusters, but in the detection of the white dwarf really has relatively little to say about the planet. Okay, what's really important is what I showed you a minute ago, that the timing data now really tells you that the mass of this object is right around Jupiter mass. That's what's really new and important. And it's not
really out.
I think I'm going to leave it at that.